Hello, this is Beth Ludwig from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the October issue of Good Housekeeping magazine. I'd like to start with the Ask Heloise column. The first question is, cookie crummy. How can I remove cooked on grease from a cookie sheet where no dough was placed? Mine is a brown, tacky mess. Here's Heloise's answer. Spraying oil all over the sheet or greasing the whole pan is how you get that baked on brown mess. Here's how to remove it. Soak the sheet in really hot water to soften the gunk. Use a synthetic scrubbing pad designed for cookware, not metal or anything that might scratch the surface. Dampen the scrubber and add a squirt of dish soap and then sprinkle baking soda on top. Be sure to scrub in all directions. Let sit after scrubbing for 5 to 10 minutes, then rinse with hot water. If the buildup is really bad, you may need to repeat. Next question. I washed and dried my lip balm along with the laundry. As a result, I found scattered spots on the fabric a little darker than the material's color. Please help. Here's Heloise's answer. This will take elbow grease. Place several paper towels underneath the fabric, one layer, and apply dry cleaning solvent. You find it with other laundry products on the spots. Put a paper towel on top and using a big heavy spoon, tap the stains to work the balm through the material to the paper towel. Air dry. You may have to do this several times. Our first article is called How Animal Babies Can Save the World. By writing popular books about endangered species, a dad and his daughters help kids tackle some of life's toughest topics. By Judith Stone. Owen was orphaned by the devastating tsunami of 2004. Swept out to the sea off the coast of Kenya, stranded on a coral reef and saved by villagers and visitors, the 600-pound, 2-foot baby hippo, named after one of his rescuers, was taken to a nearby animal sanctuary. The staff placed him in a large, leafy enclosure with a 130-year-old giant tortoise called Mizzi, wise old man in Swahili, a grumpy loner just about the hippo's size. Perhaps because Mizzi's dome shell reminded him of his lost mother's shape, Owen, about a year old, toddled behind the tortoise and tried to cuddle. Rebuffed with hisses, he persisted. Mizzi's resistance eventually melted, and the next morning, the two were discovered snuggled side by side. Soon they were inseparable, foraging and napping together. Not long after the animals surprised scientists by bonding, mammals and reptiles rarely became BFFs. Isabel Hatkoff, then a first grader, was reading the newspaper with her dad, New York City entrepreneurial Craig Hatkoff, at the desk in his home office. She spotted a photo of Owen and Mizzi and was instantly smitten. "Daddy," the six-year-old asked, "can this be our book?" It was Isabella's turn to collaborate with her father. He and her older sister, Juliana, 10 at the time, had already written two children's books together. Hatkoff emailed Paula Kahumba, an ecologist who was then head of the Haller Park Animal Sanctuary, Owen's new home, and suggested they join forces. She agreed. And that's how the award-winning bestseller, Owen and Mizzi, The True Story of a Remarkable Friendship, came to be. Since then, Hatkoff, 55, Isabella, now 10, and Juliana, 14, have teamed with experts to write 4 more nonfiction kids' picture books about endangered animal babies. Each is a ripping good adventure that also offers lessons in resilience and explains a threat to the environment in child-sized bites. Besides two books about Owen and Mezzi, there are Nut, How One Little Polar Bear Captivated the World, and Looking for Miza, the true story of mountain gorilla family who rescued one of their own. The trio's latest, out this month, is Winter's Tale, How One Little Dolphin Learned to Swim Again, about a baby dolphin who had lost her tail when she got tangled in a crab trap off the Florida coast. Nursed back to health at the Clearwater Marine Aquarium, she's now the owner of a prosthetic tail created by a designer of artificial limbs for veterans, athletes, and others. Though the books, all published by Scholastic Press, are pitched to a primary school audience, they've been embraced by older kids and educators. At the Newport Mills Middle School in Maryland, for example, lessons on dealing with losses are built around Owen and Mezzi, named the Best Illustrated Children's Book of 2007 by the American Booksellers Association. In 2008, Hatkoff created the Owens and Mezzi Foundation to rally kids' support for conservation projects and host educational events like the last year's Kids Gorilla Summit, co-sponsored by Clinton Global Initiative and Scholastic. Students from six New York City schools attended in person, joined by thousands more in classrooms around the world watching a webcast. The foundation has donated money to pay the salaries of park rangers protecting the desperately imperiled mountain gorillas of Virunga National Park in Rwanda and the war-torn Democratic Republic of the Congo, and funded a biofuel project so the refugees living in the Virunga Mountains won't have to cut down trees, gorillas' habitat and food source, for their cooking fires. It also supports the work of Wildlife Direct, a nonprofit dedicated to saving endangered animals that was founded by famed fellow anthropologist Richard Leakey. Thousands of children have signed a Kids Global Act pledging to help protect gorillas. Many of them have held fundraisers. Starting this month, children's suggestions for keeping dolphins safe will be posted at winterstale.com. It's a kids' philanthropic micro-movement, says Hatkoff with delight, and it all began with inflamed tonsils. In 2000, when Juliana was nearly five and anxious about an upcoming tonsillectomy, Hatkoff recalls he and his wife, film producer Jane Rosenthal, looked for a good kids' book to calm their daughter. We couldn't find what we needed, he said, so we decided to keep a notebook illustrated by Juliana, who always loved to draw. I helped her write down what she was afraid of, and then we researched each step of the procedure. Recording the experience proved diverting and comforting. Hatkoff and Rosenthal showed Juliana's notebook to an editor who thought it would help other kids and transformed it into Goodbye Tonsils, with a foreword for parents by Howard Kolepskwick, director of New York University Child Study Center. The second father-daughter collaboration emerged from the need to deal with a far more frightening event, the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center in 2001. Juliana wanted to do something to help, Hatkoff says, so she brought her duct tape coin bank to a fire station nearby and made a donation. The family struck up a close friendship with one of the firefighters. When Dr. Kupalex mentioned that he could use a book to help kids traumatized by 9/11, Hatkoff thought the tonsil formula might work again. He and Juliana wrote a candid child's eye account of the devastating day and its aftermath. It became the touching but unsentimental e-book, Ladder 35, Engine 40. You can view it free, online, or download and print it for $2.30 at ebooks.ebookmail.com. When Isabella spotted the newspaper photo of Owen and Mezzi, Hatkoff saw another chance to help parents and kids tackle difficult real-life subjects in a compelling, common-sense, and compassionate way. Father and daughter began working long distance with Kahumba, now head of the Wildlife District, Isabella, an animal lover, so dedicated that she spoon-fed a crippled pet lizard daily for 2 years, threw herself into learning about hippos and tortoises with an assist from Juliana. Big Sister rejoined the team for books about Nut, an abandoned polar bear who became the star of the Berlin Zoo, Mizza, a lost and found gorilla that Kumba heard from the rangers at Virunga, and Winter, the dolphin. Hadkoff does the writing, the girls help with the research, discuss the direction of the story, and make written comments on text. We work together in my office in short bursts, he says. We have other jobs. Mom sometimes weighs in with opinions. But my role is cheerleader, says Rosenthal. I think it's great that the girls have this project with Craig. Through these animal stories, they learned about humankind, how they're part of the world at large, and how they can make a difference. Isabella, who liked to run an animal sanctuary when she grows up, has thought a lot about what she hopes kids will get out of the book she has helped create. Owen and Mizzy and Nut and Winter are all very cute animals, she says. But the real message is that there is hope from something really sad. Even if you do lose your mom, like Owen, and your tail, like Winter, or if your brother gets a fever and passes away, which happened to Nut. She just watched a documentary about Winter made by the Clearwater Aquarium, shown as part of a family day at the Tribeca Film Festival, which her parents co-founded in 2002 to revitalize Lower Manhattan after 9/11. Kids can learn from Winter's tale that if they have a handicap or disability, that doesn't necessarily mean they can't do something. I think the books are another way of connecting with children, she adds. If you have a 3-year-old and you're trying to explain global warming in really long words, they're sitting there like, what? But if you use a book that has cute baby animals in it, it's a lot easier. You can say, this polar bear's home is melting, and polar bears might all die. Last year, Hatkoff and Juliana, who's now a 9th grader, attended a gorilla naming ceremony in Rwanda. What struck her, she says, was the realization that you can't help gorillas without helping people, because they compete for scarce resources. She and her dad accompanied medical workers through a rural clinic in Rwanda on a home visit to a patient. While we're waiting in the car, Hatkoff recalls, Juliana gave one of our bottles of water to a child. 3 or 4 more kids came running over, and she gave them bottles of water. All of a sudden, there were kids all around, and we had no more water bottles. She turned to me and said, Daddy, what do we do? It was an aha moment. When you don't have enough resources, how do you make those difficult decisions? That's what it means to be a global citizen. That's what it means to be human. I told Juliana that she spends the rest of her life thinking about the answer to that question, Hadkoff says. I don't have the answers, but I may have the tools. My grandfather was a mason, and my father was a carpenter. He taught me how to hammer and lay bricks. We're giving our girls different tools for building their world. We want our books to be tools for engaging people in conversation. From the first, Hadkoff and his daughters hoped to generate world-changing dialogue, but they never thought one of the most attention-getting conversations would be between a hippo and a tortoise. Within a year of forging their rare interspecies bond, Owen and Mizzy startled scientists again, by creating what seems to be a unique animal language, a soft, deep rumbling the pair only uses with each other, sounds made by neither tortoises nor hippos in the wild. This unprecedented milestone is an unlikely friendship, perfectly reflects, Hadkoff thinks, the themes that most move him and his 2 girls. How animals, humans included, cope with adversity, care for each other, and communicate against all odds. In the good advice section, the article is titled, You Know I'm Right, How to Deal with a Certainty Freak, Even If It's You, by Michelle Stacy. I try biting my tongue. Too late. It doesn't work. See, we should have taken that exit for the Jamestown Bridge. I can't help pointing out, if gnashing teeth can actually make a sound, that's what I'm hearing from my husband in the driver's seat. And then he can't bite his tongue either. You always have to be right, don't you? No, I protest inwardly, I don't. We've had this conversation countless times, and over the years I've dismissed his recurring accusation as springing from what I would politely call frustration over the fact that too often he's been very wrong. I've been like the woman in the old shampoo commercial who obnoxiously crowed, "Don't hate me because I'm beautiful." Only that script runs in my head. "Don't hate me because I'm smart, right, one step ahead of you." I'm still the first grader with her hand eagerly in the air. My husband of quite a few years and I really do enjoy each other's company most of the time. Every couple, however, has its own mythology of perpetually recycled sins, and my certainty has been part of ours. But this day on the road, when I hear that have to be right line, I stop and reassess the concept. Do I always have to be right? Perhaps my soul-searching is prompted by a bit of wisdom my husband has been quoting lately from a much-wed friend of his. The secret to a happy marriage is to just keep repeating, "You were right, dear." While I detest thinking of myself as an overbearing diva demanding constant victory, I have to admit that beyond the condensation, there should be some truth in that advice. Maybe admitting a partner's rightness and your own wrongness, or at least being capable of give and take, is some kind of marriage glue. Heck, maybe it's relationship glue in general, not just with spouses, but with friends, parents, children, and bosses. Then why is it so important to many people, including me, to feel or be acknowledged to be right? And is there a way of dealing with this need that is big-hearted and forgiving rather than corrosive? Part of the answer to this question comes straight from the brain, which seems to crave a sense of certainty, says Robert Burton, M.D., former chief of neurology at UCSF Medical Center at Mount Zion, and author of Being Certain. If you stimulate someone's brain physically in a particular way, Dr. Burton says, you can create a feeling of knowing without any actual thought behind it, suggesting that we have a receptor system that predisposes us to hanker after rightness, a spot just waiting to be turned on by the experience. The brain needs to have a sense that it has completed a line of thinking, Dr. Burton says, and it's not comfortable until it does. Also, he notes, certain feel-good engineering a sense of contentment and satisfaction and dispelling anxiety. Another thing hardwired into our brains, besides pleasure in feeling right, is displeasure at encountering cognitive dissonance. That's the bad feeling we get when a belief we hold is contradicted by evidence we don't want to hear. One logical response to this discomfort of cognitive dissonance is insisting that you're not wrong, that in fact you are right. But clearly some people are able to live with ambiguity. They can agree to disagree or entertain the notion that there is no right in this situation, that both sides have some validity or that we'll just never know. Says Dr. Burton, all the research I've seen points to people having an innate personal set point for the need of certainty, or you could flip it around and call it a tolerance for ambiguity. Just as we seem to have a set point for happiness, anxiety, and neatness. And neither sex is more likely to be insistence than the other, he notes. It isn't about the know-it-all man or the self-righteous woman, experts agree. There may be a difference of style, but not a difference of degree. Biology is only part of this story. Being certain we know that we know involves feelings, fears, insecurities, jealousies, in short, psychology. And here's where getting honest with myself becomes more challenging. When you can't give ground, even on small things, it suggests that you don't feel good about yourself, says the professor of psychiatry and psychology at Ohio State University. How much we need to defend our rightness, she feels, boils down to two factors, self-esteem and a sense of control over one's life. Now we're talking. I had to cop to my need for control a long time ago. In fact, that's another accusation my husband has been known to fling. You're so controlling. Blame it on the family dysfunction of my childhood. Were my parents going to split up? Would we have enough money to live on? Did my battling parents really love my sister and me? But I've always felt compelled to know exactly what's going on in any given situation and try to somehow direct the outcome. Those compulsions can get even stronger when you hit a rough patch or face a new challenge. If you're feeling good about your life, being right may not matter so much. But when events in your life are unpredictable, that's stressful, and it can play out in a greater need to feel in control by insisting you're right about something. You can feel like, at least I know this for sure. Take the new job I started not long ago. Naturally, anybody in this situation wants to impress, to please, to prove his or her worth, and feels a bit on edge. All of which may help explain how I found myself failing to give ground in a meeting with my boss. Not the way to please the powers that be, but on this particular issue, I was so sure she was overlooking the true benefits of seeing it my way, and if I could just elaborate a little more. Luckily, mid-explanation, I was stopped by a blinding insight. It's better to be happily employed than to be right. Similarly, it's better to be happily married than to be right. And the realization, even though I probably have to experience it over and over again, was my first baby step toward loosening the bonds of my rightness compulsion. There are many great reasons for shedding the need to be right. Doing so can improve not only the health of our relationships, but also the health of our bodies. Clinical studies of interpersonal conflict that arises in situations involving nastiness and hostility, which can certainly occur when one person in a relationship insists on being right. Studies show such tension affects immune response. It's connected to an increase in stress hormones, slower healing of wounds, and a higher level of inflammation. Women show a greater physiological response to hostile situations than men do. And that's just the physical story. The emotional hit you take every time your partner or friend demands that you bow to his or her correctness, or the damage done every time you issue the same demand, becomes a wedge. The effects on a relationship of an intense need to be right are miserable, with the one who gives in reluctantly usually coming to feel bitter and annoyed by the bully. Eventually, the bully's target withdraws, stops speaking up, and stops being honest. Not good for a close relationship. Take my best college friend, whom I'll call Leslie. We were truly close and still are, despite the fact that at some point during our undergraduate years, she designated herself my surrogate older sister. She issued endless advice and commentary about everything from the character flaws of the guys I dated to the caliber of classes I was taking, and there was no use arguing. She'd even throw in some psychoanalytical backup for good measure since she was studying to be a therapist. Our relationship somehow survived this onslaught, but not without some anger on my part. Fruitless anger, since I felt that to challenge her conclusion was to jump into a bog of pressure and conflict. I saw her again recently after years of geographical and emotional distance, and at the end of the evening she said, "There's something I've been meaning to tell you." Oh God, I thought, here it comes. Decades ago I committed some kind of crime, and now I'm going to hear about it. Instead, she said, "When I accused you of not being there for me when I broke up with Jack my senior year, that really wasn't right or fair. I had my own issues going on that led me to saying that, and I was wrong, and I know I was hurtful to you. Our friendship started again that night. I was absolutely floored, relieved by, and grateful for her generosity and willing to admit of being wrong. Even better, it gave me faith that this right-wrong dysfunction is far from irretractable, and that people can actually change and mature. You don't have to be stuck forever being either the know-it-all or the frustrated party. The fix begins with dredging all of this interior action, insecurity, need for control, the brain's inherent urge to be certain, to a conscious level. Difficult though that seems at times, it's possible. Dr. Burton suggests starting with the realization that our first response to any situation is primarily reflexive, created by pre-existing beliefs and biases. In other words, our thoughts spring from spontaneous, subjective, and often prejudiced feelings. So stop right there. Pause and question whether your rightness is reasonable or knee-jerk, biased, and defensive. The best thing is to go even further. Momentarily assume that the opposing view might actually be correct. Consider the alternative. Imagine that there may be possible solutions that neither of you have even thought about. Who could possibly be so wise? Well, you and I could, unless we want to live as slaves to our own impulses. Here's the thing. We know from brainwave testing that our brains are constantly making decisions way before we become conscious of them. But what humans have is veto power over these processes. The veto power is the main thing that separates us from animals. You can hold your tongue for a second, and then you can think consciously, I don't have to say that. That's an incredible freedom. And once you go there, you realize there's also relief in ceasing to insist you're right or in admitting you may have been mistaken, even decades later, as with Leslie and me. Why do we feel so reluctant to say these little words of apology? I've always felt that the second sweetest three-word phrase in the English language is, I was wrong, followed by, you are right. Also, I don't know. These are generous things to say, and people feel immediately grateful when they hear them. Their anger is diffused. And if you're caught on the other side, if, as I was in college, you feel trapped by another person's relentless insistence upon rightness, there are conscious ways to respond to that. Rather than firing back with every weapon at hand, or retreating resentfully as I did with Leslie, you can try to open a better dialogue by gently redirecting the conversation. When you feel someone is wrong, but unlikely to easily admit it, try saying something like this. I am confused about this, or I don't understand what you meant, or I think we may be talking past each other. What was I thinking? Those kind of statements are less likely to arouse a person's reflective defensiveness. Then, if the other person does convince you of her rightness, you can have the pleasure of saying truthfully, yes, you're right. Or you can decide that you're both right. Who knows? Maybe someday we'll also be so highly evolved that instead of pressing our point, we can cheerfully say, as did the 13th century Persian poet Rumi, out beyond right and wrong, there is a field. I'll meet you there. I'm guessing that it can be found just over the Jamestown Bridge. We've run out of time for today's episode of From Soups to Nuts. I've been reading from the October issue of Good Housekeeping magazine. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Beth Ludwig, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. So long, until next time.